I want to quickly go over 15 again, even though we've covered it, just because it's pertinent to the slide coming up. And also, it's good to review a little bit. Recall that if we are degrading saturated fatty acid, that's a straightforward situation. All we need is several iterations of the cycle, each involving the four enzymes, right? You remember the order of the four enzymes? Without looking? Well, the enzymes themselves. Yes, acyl coenzyme A dehydrogenase first, then enol coenzyme A hydratase, then L3 hydroxyacyl coenzyme A dehydrogenase, and then finally beta thiolase, exactly. Once all four of those work, what you have is an acetyl coenzyme A on its own, carrying two carbons, of course, and an acyl coenzyme A that includes a fatty acyl whose carbon skeleton is now two carbons shorter than it was. And if all we have are single bonds, a saturated fatty acyl, then that just continues until you're done. What we talked about in 15 was that if you have an unsaturated fatty acid, and therefore an unsaturated acyl coenzyme A, then eventually you run into the problem of coming up upon this double bond, right? In which case, you have to use a supplementary enzyme to get around that problem, which is what cis-delta-3 enol coenzyme A isomerase was, right? That takes the cis double bond here, breaks that, and transforms this thing into a trans-delta-2 enol coenzyme A, which is exactly what you need. That's just part of the normal four-step process, so now you're back in the game again. All right. Well, if this is a monounsaturated fat, then you're done. Just one use of this enzyme, and you continue on as though it were a saturated fat to begin with, right? Because there aren't any more double bonds left. But not all saturated fats or fatty acids are monounsaturated fatty acids. We have polyunsaturated fatty acids as well, meaning that they have at least two, maybe more, double bonds in the fatty acyl that's carried by coenzyme A. So that brings us to slide 16. Now, even if you assume that it is a polyunsaturated fatty acyl being carried by coenzyme A, there are still two fundamentally different possibilities. One of those is that two double bonds are very close to each other, as close together as they're going to be in a fatty acyl, meaning that there's only one carbon between the two double bonds, as you see up on the top in linoleoyl coenzyme A, as specific example. That's all. That's the only importance about that name, is that it's an example shown here. So you have a CH2 only between the two double bonds. What is that CH2 called? A methylene group, yes. Okay, but the other possibility is that the two double bonds, or at least two of the however many there are more separated. If they're more separated, then the enzyme really can't tell that there's multiple double bonds there. It just encounters the first one and processes it just like we did in the last slide, and then continues on its way with the normal four enzymes, and then it gets to another double bond and processes it as though it were the first double bond, or the only one. But when the two double bonds are very close to each other and separated only by this methylene group, that presents another special problem. So we're going to have to introduce another enzyme. But let's look at this stepwise. First of all, in this specific example, this linoleic oil coenzyme A doesn't have a problem as far as double bonds until you get part of the way down the chain, because notice there's a CH2-4. So you go through three rounds of the normal saturated way of breaking it down with normal four enzymes, and then you encounter the first double bond. All right, well, just as we usually do for a double bond, we then use this supplementary enzyme, cis-delta-3-enol coenzyme A isomerase. That's going to deal with this first double bond. Then we have one more round of the normal four enzymes. That's what this single black arrow represents. Okay? And that's going to then put this second double bond in the C4 and 5 positions. Okay? Now you go ahead and use acyl coenzyme A dehydrogenase, which is the first enzyme of the four, right, for another round. And that's going to cause the problem, because when acyl coenzyme A dehydrogenase operates on this acyl coenzyme A, it's going to form an example of, once again, this is just a category name, not a specific name, it's going to form an example of a 2,4-dienoyl coenzyme A. It's diene because there's two double bonds, right? And the two double bonds are at carbons 2 and 4. So 2,4-dienoyl coenzyme A is a problem because it doesn't work with the normal next enzyme in the iteration steps. Okay? So we've already used one of these special enzymes to deal with the first double bond. Now we need an enzyme we haven't even talked about yet to deal with this second double bond. And that's the second yellow box here. 2,4-dienoyl coenzyme A reductase. Well named, because it takes the stuff that it's named for and reduces it. Okay, specifically, what that achieves is a breaking of both of these double bonds and forming one double bond between the carbons that were between the double bonds. Okay? Well, to do that, to break two double bonds and just form one double bond, you need to add some hydrogens in order to make up those extra bonds. And that's why it's a reductase doing that. By adding the hydrogens, you satisfy the valences of the carbons who have lost a bond when the double bond was broken. All right? So the reason when that happens, what you form is a trans-delta-3-enol coenzyme A. Well, that's still not what you need, right? Because in the normal cycle, using the four normal enzymes, what you need is a trans-delta-2-enol coenzyme A for that enzyme to work. In other words, this double bond is in the wrong position. We've achieved converting from two double bonds to one, which is halfway dealing with the problem, but that double bond now is still in the wrong place. So we're going to need another enzyme that operates in these special cases, but notice that it's the same enzyme that worked originally. And this is why this name doesn't make any sense for what it's doing in this situation. Cis-delta-3-enol coenzyme A isomerase, the first supplemental enzyme, that's named for what it's been doing up to now that we've been talking about. That name makes sense in that context. But it also happens to be able to transform a trans-delta-3-enol coenzyme A into a trans-delta-2. In which case the name doesn't make sense, but it does the job as well. All right? In other words, this upper yellow box is the same enzyme as the left box and the yellow box in the previous slide. So there's only two supplemental enzymes beyond the four normal ones that are operating in this process, but the first of those two supplemental enzymes works in two different ways. Everyone clear on that? Well, after the operation of the all of this, once you have a trans-delta-2 enol coenzyme A, however long it is, it doesn't matter, you're back in the regular cycle, and therefore can continue using your four regular enzymes, cleaving off two carbons at a time in the form of an acetyl group carried by coenzyme A. Okay? So that really takes care of all fats except for one situation. What we've been assuming so far is that the carbon skeleton is composed of an even number of carbons. How long it is, if it's even, doesn't matter. You just keep going through the cycle a number of times until you're done, right? And if it's monounsaturated, polyunsaturated, or saturated, we've dealt with all of those possibilities. But some fatty acids are odd-numbered carbon-containing, and therefore when you get to the end, when you have five carbons left and you take off another acetyl coenzyme A, you're left with three, and therefore you have a three-carbon compound that last coenzyme A is carrying, instead of just a two, which you would have after the final iteration for an even-numbered. The final one for an even-numbered is just another coenzyme A. I mean, acetyl coenzyme A, right? But when you have an odd number, you have three left being carried by that final coenzyme A, and that stuff is called propionyl coenzyme A. Same root as in propane, right? Which means three carbons. Well, that means we need to deal with that situation. It's really not that much of a problem. Everything else is exactly the same with respect to whether it's saturated, monounsaturated, or polyunsaturated. It's just that if it's odd, you're going to eventually end up with a propionyl coenzyme A. So we need one final pathway to deal with the propionyl coenzyme A, and that's what you see in 18. Stepwise, it is converted into succinyl coenzyme A. And where do you suppose that gets sent? Citric acid cycle, exactly. It's a citric acid cycle intermediate. So if you can convert it into that, the cell can't tell whether it's from a fatty acid or from glucose originally. Okay, so this is a stepwise pathway, which is redundant. It's a pathway. The first step is to transform propionyl coenzyme A into the delta form of methylmalonyl coenzyme A. And notice that that involves a carboxylation step. The pink C and two O's is a carboxyl group that is being added to this three-carbon propionyl. So methylmalonyl is a four-carbon compound. Okay. Well, carbon dioxide is needed for this to add the C and the two O's. But what is the principle? How is carbon dioxide actually occurring for the most part in body fluids? Not as actual carbon dioxide, but as bicarbonate ions, right? Remember the reversible reaction? Carbon dioxide and water form carbonic acid, which then splits apart into protons and bicarbonate ions, which are in solution. So that's why this thing is showing bicarbonate. It's really just the dissolved form of carbon dioxide, but that's the source of the carbon and the two oxygens for this carboxylation step. And it is a carboxylation step, so it makes sense for the enzyme to be named propionyl coenzyme A carboxylase. That will get you the D form of methylmalonyl coenzyme A, but that needs to be transformed into the L form. So the only difference between these two, notice, is a switch of the positions of the H and the methyl. Notice that the H is behind the plane of the screen here, and the methyl's in front, just the opposite on the other one. So what kind of isomers are these two, the D and the L version? Remember your... They are not enantiomers because that means a complete left and right hand version. They're not completely left and right hand versions. They are an example of a stereoisomer, but stereoisomers are broken down into enantiomers and diastereoisomers. There are two different kinds of diastereoisomers: anomers involving the ring, and what else? Epimers, exactly. These are epimers of each other. So that explains the name of the second enzyme, which is methylmalonyl coenzyme A epimerase. Well, that's one isomerization. Now we're going to undergo another one, though. The methylmalonyl coenzyme A, the L version of that, is going to finally be transformed into succinyl coenzyme A. Same number of carbons, but notice that the methylmalonyl versions has a branched structure, whereas succinyl is linear. Right? See what I'm saying? See the branch point here in the carbon skeleton? So what happens in this final reaction of this pathway is that the coenzyme A and the carbon that it's carrying, the CO group that it's carrying, which is the black right-hand side, just not the whole black thing, but just the right-hand side of it, that actually gets taken off of there and gets stuck onto the blue carbon that's in the methyl. And so now you have this black carbon used to be this one. I mean, it is this one. It's connected here, so it's a linear arrangement now. No branches. And to do that, you need to displace a hydrogen from the methyl and put it over onto the carbon that you detached from, which is this hydrogen right here, or one of those two. Okay? So what we're doing is just moving functional groups from one place in a particle to another place in that same particle, right? And therefore, it's what kind of an enzyme? It is a mutase. It's called specifically methylmalonyl coenzyme A mutase. So that gets you succinyl coenzyme A straight into the citric acid cycle, no problem. It can be processed just like any other succinyl coenzyme A and lead to ATP production. So that's all the possibilities with respect to fatty acid degradation. There's only a couple slides left, and these deal with the generation of ketone bodies. And I don't want to spend a lot of time on this because it's the minority of, by far the minority of the acetyl coenzyme A that's generated by fatty acid degradation gets turned into ketone bodies. Most of it feeds directly into the citric acid cycle and therefore efficiently leads to ATP production. But a certain low level of ketone body production is always occurring. And one reason why that's useful is because even though ketone bodies don't actually end up making as much ATP for you as the acetyl coenzyme A before you modify it into a ketone body, the advantage is that the ketone bodies can be easily transported in the blood to other tissues because they are more soluble. All right? But since this is not really what's happening for the most part, I'm not going to hold you to these enzyme names. I just want to quickly go through these steps. This is slide 19, though. Notice on the left, the pink and the blue are just two acetyl coenzyme A's. They're identical, that result from degrading a fatty acid. Well, in ketone body formation, there are three major ketone bodies: acetoacetate, 3-hydroxybutyrate, and acetone. But notice those all come from the same starting point. So two different acetyl coenzyme A's are going to interact to form acetoacetyl coenzyme A. And notice what's happening here is that you're just combining two carbon units into a four carbon unit, right? That then gets transformed into 3-hydroxy-3-methylglutaryl coenzyme A. What's really happening is you're just adding another coenzyme A, acetyl coenzyme A in green. But then you release one coenzyme A, or acetyl coenzyme A in pink, leaving this four carbon structure with two double bonds. That's what acetoacetate is. And that's why these things are called ketone bodies, because these carbonyls are this blue carbonyl here is not terminal, right? It's a ketone. It's a keto group. Well, that's one of the ketone bodies, but that can get transformed into 3-hydroxybutyrate via NADH. On the other hand, acetoacetate can also be transformed into acetone, and that occurs even without the help of an enzyme. It just kind of gradually, slowly happens spontaneously. But those are the three ketone bodies, and tissues can use those as fuel. Like I said, it just doesn't add up to quite as many ATP, but some tissues actually do very well with these fuels and seem to prefer them, which might be true for heart muscle, for instance. And the brain, remember I said that the brain usually uses nothing but glucose, except under starvation conditions when you're producing a lot of ketone bodies. And the brain actually not only does well on ketone bodies, it actually works quite well. It's just that in a starvation situation, unless you eat, it's not going to be working very well for very long. Well, using these things is just a matter of transforming them, as you see in slide 20, back into acetyl coenzyme A when they get to the cells that take them up. And that just involves a dehydrogenation, a transfer of the acyl from a change in job of the coenzyme that is in succinyl coenzyme A carrying succinyl. Instead, it picks up the acetoacetate. So that's why you have acetoacetyl coenzyme A. And now succinate is on its own. And then finally, a thiolase to turn it back into acetyl coenzyme A. And I think that is the last one. So that's one chapter.